So I start off the essay with a quote from Rajiv Ji's 2002 Sulekha essay, which Sankranji also referred to in the morning. He talks about the role of a historian doing two things. One can be nation builder and one can be nation unbuilder. So fundamentally, Guha's role has been as a nation unbuilder. So Guha is sort of an example of both a fibril and a dystorian, and his goal is to cause anarchy.
T.N. Sudarshan is a computer scientist by profession with expertise in the fields of AI and related technologies. Apart from technology, consulting for startups, he is also actively involved with research initiatives. I kindly request T.N. Sudarshan to present on Ramchandra Guha.
Namaste all. So I'll just keep this presentation a bit light. Okay, we had a pretty heavy day, I assume. So, and luckily for us, we have a very flippant character. So, we have this person called Ramchandra Guha, right? So, the sort of subtitle or the descriptor I have given to Guha is sort of in the modern hashtag form. I call him the anarchic fibril dystorian. Okay. Now, these words fibril and dystorian, both of them are, you could find them in the urban dictionary. Okay. So, the word fib actually means somebody who sort of lies, as I say, lying through the hat. Okay. So, the liberals and the principles of liberalism built on lies, okay, builds on fibs. So, those kind of scholars or those kind of, that kind of rhetoric is called, those kind of people are labeled fibrils. Then we had this usage of the word dystorian by General Bakshi ji. So these are people who do history by distorting facts, by giving you false facts and false interpretation of facts. So Guha is sort of an example of both a fibril and a dystorian, and his goal is to cause anarchy. Now, this theory of anarchy is basically to distort and sort of attack all consistent and stable structures in society, okay, which is sort of one of the features of Marxism, Marxist dialectic per se. Now, I have a lot of descriptions of why he is important. He's got all the big potentially, let's say, what you would call high quality labels of intellectual achievement. Okay, so professor at LSE, an award at the American Historical Association. So he's a historian. He's a prolific writer. So probably has written easily close to 50,000 pages and more across his books, articles, and his interviews. So now he's the, I mean, if you sort of take a volume centric and also quality centric and a range centric view of intellectual output, he is probably the most prolific authority on the history of contemporary India, meaning post-1900, let's say, right? He is also the recipient of the Padma Bhushan in 2009. Now, why is this, so again, more accolades, Guardian, Economist, Washington Post, Wall Street Journal, Book of the Decade, so all of these. So, he's sort of the sort of mega superstar in the left-wing, I wouldn't call left liberal, but mainstream English sort of humanities, history, commentary, cricket, all of these sort of areas, environment. So there's all, so the labeling of Guha as a widely read and widely accomplished intellectual is very difficult to critique, simply because he does not give you, shall we say, entry points into actually the point that Rajiv ji mentioned as to what is it that is driving his theory. And you wouldn't find wrong facts. Okay, you would find selective quoting of facts, but you wouldn't find any direct quotes or direct errors in most of his analysis and theories that he builds on. So now I've also used our new scholar in the field, okay, OpenChat GPT, to tell us why he is important. Okay, if you could read at the bottom, so I just asked it, why is Ramchandra Guha important? So it lists a bunch of things. And then he says See, Ramachandra Guha overall is an important figure in Indian intellectual life due to his scholarship, activism, and public engagement. He has made significant contributions to our understanding of Indian history, politics, and society. And his work continues to inspire and influence scholars and intellectuals around the world. So as of today, his writings span probably the largest spectrum of issues, and his commentary is considered to be an intellectual for intellectuals, right? So he's like one meta level above the average intellectual, both in the considered to be both the left space and in the sort of newly mushrooming right wing space also. You find very little critique of Guha rather than in very flippant ways that he's attacked by the current crop of right wing writers. So now I sort of give you a few examples on his spin. He's authored a book called Spin, but I'll just put it for humor. So now some of his most popular works are his works on Gandhi and Nehru. Right? So it's very important sort of narrative on Gandhi. Right? So Gandhi sort of uses Gandhi to say that bhakti, okay, was something that Gandhi fundamentally ignored. Okay? So now what he says is Hinduism before Gandhi never had this idea of service or ahimsa or any of those things. Right? So he uses Gandhi to delegitimize the idea of a civilization and as a prop for pushing contemporary intervention into polity and public discourse. It's a very consistent feature of his commentary. So both Gandhi and Nehru, who are sort of considered symbols of modern India, are used to create Hindu-phobic tropes. Now this is again, he keeps sort of a regular feature, and this is like a tweet 10 years ago. So he says that Gandhi actually was in opposition to Bhagavan himself. Okay? So now I'll leave it to your interpretations. This is the level of narrative and interactivity and intellectual arrogance that Guha has got, that he feels that his only target left today is Bhagavan. See, nobody else stands in front of him. So he uses Krishna, attacks Krishna, Rama, etc., using the works of Gandhi himself. Another thing is this whole genre of Nehru writing. Okay, he writes all sorts of different takes on Nehru's achievements, Nehru's what Nehru thought, impact of Nehru, and all of that. And more importantly, he sort of extols him as the most important kind of Brahmin that a Brahmin should be. It's very important. So though he sort of uses the anti-casteist lens and all of that, he uses his own label of being a Brahmin to actually delegitimize the traditional notion of what Brahminhood actually means. Right? So the most aspirational Brahmin for any Brahmin today is Nehru. Okay? So this sort of deep sabotage of many layers of the plurality of the current socio-cultural narrative of India. So now, okay, superficially it looks like, okay, he's trying to whitewash Nehru, sort of praise him, etc., etc. So though he sort of ignores the Nehru's grave blunders and Nehru's sort of well-known effects that we are seeing today, the larger motive is basically this, right? The whole notion of him to be actually, which actually happened for us. The reason for the whole Nehruvian era is he was considered to be the most sort of aspired to personality by a large class of the so-called elite in India, right? So then there's also some other take on Lal Bahadur Shastri. So we all know the recent movie on Shastriji's demise. So it's all very peculiar style. Okay, so he sort of blames Shastri for his own death. Okay, so he doesn't talk about it. He says it's speculative. There could be many causes for this. So, but he also said that probably he did not have the right clothes. He was wearing all too much of a dhoti and a kurta in Russia. So probably he died. So he actually knew what really happened. So he preempts that by saying that the question is one must ask is not how he died, right? But what if he had lived for another 5 or 10 years? And then he gives a different narrative on why Shastri would have been bad for India. So all of that, I can sort of give examples in the essay. So now the larger exercise that we are doing is to unpack the Siddhanta that is using. Okay, so I use a very, this is sort of very popular picture that he keeps recirculating on Twitter and also used by different people in the press to sort of give a air of intellectual superiority to Guha. And he sort of likes this whole notion of, you know, it sort of takes Snooty to a new level, right? So I sort of use this as a meme to actually tell you where he gets his Siddhanta from. So some of his key, so the key thing here is he doesn't use any new theories or doesn't create any ones, but he uses existing Western ones to create new sort of narratives under that theory. Now this is something very interesting. So he's the only guy who will equate Hinduism and Islam as one and the same when it comes to treating women. Then he uses the tropes of upper and lower caste, city and village, Brahmin, Dalit, Hindu, Muslim. More than 30 to 40% of his output is to just focus on these divisions. So sort of this comes under the larger framework of subalternism. Then as the colonialist, okay. So despite the vile motive of the British and the excesses of Churchill, his whole thesis is that without the British, India would never have been a modern country. And more importantly, again, just like Bakshi pointed out, the line that India had no prior indigenous civilization that was significant enough to be proud of or worthy enough to be spoken about. This is a major theme in his work. And he sort of, since he's sort of considered to be an intellectual writer, his output actually influences a large part of the sort of wannabe intellectual who sort of reads his stuff to figure out how to write complicated, you know, sentences, how to write impressive paragraphs, how to write data-driven and narrative-driven, powerfully sort of pedigreed output. And then there is this genre of nationalism. Okay, again pointed out by both by Anurag and Subhajit. Right, this whole notion of splitting dharmic faiths into different categories. And again, this again keeps coming again and again, pointed out by Bakshiji, by Madhu Kishoreji also. This whole notion of assertion of Hindus is the most dangerous of all, simply because of this notion of, because they are in majority, you have to keep as tolerant and as quiet as possible. Okay, then this whole, this sort of his main theme on Marxism, right? He says the three things that Marx mostly got right. So he says that British helped get India, get rid of caste. You just had Bakshiji give a 20-minute talk on how they introduced caste into India. So you have exactly opposite narrative saying Marx was a person via Marx. So any quotes, any such major theories of Guha will not be through him directly. Either Gandhi said that Krishna is irrelevant or Marx said that the British helped India get rid of caste. Okay, so you'll never get him, you'll never catch him directly saying any of these things. Next thing is his vicious hatred for Hindutva. Okay, so again, this is again, this is sort of his most important tropes in the last couple of years. So he says in Hindutva is an ideology born out of a combination of the chosen nation syndrome. So basically reflects the Abrahamic ideas of the chosen tribe and the victim nation syndrome, right? So it gives you complicated psychoanalysis of what Hindutva is supposed to be. Another one again, which made popular social media hits couple of weeks ago, is this whole notion of why India should never become a superpower, should not become a superpower for the well-being of the world. Okay, so this is the superpower narrative, if you liberal historian version. Okay, so this is sort of the, what shall we say, the major powerhouse of leftist, intellectually driven, politically motivated narratives. So this is sort of the dream team that is currently available. So now the key thing is, so despite, again, he uses Gandhi as a facade, as a trope. So despite Gandhi building the modern democratic Indian state, he did it by overlooking deep-rooted divisions among Indians. This is something even Gandhi would not agree with. But then he uses Gandhi as a trope, as a significant entry point into his narrative. He says extremism, both left-wing and right-wing, then the whole notion of family-driven political parties, public institutions, universities and police and judiciary have deteriorated. Democratic openness is victim to corruption. the increasing gap between rich and the poor. He takes a pot shot at the Ambani Antilla house. Then he says, damaged environment, apathy of media. So the whole notion of the media has been essentially co-opted by the government corporations. And he sort of gives an example of the early 1990s when a lot of journalists became trained as finance analysts. So the whole notion of the lack of long-term policy, according to him, and territorial instability, right? So these are his 10 major reasons he says India should never even aspire to be one. So more importantly, there are too many fault lines in our society for us to be a superpower. As a historian, I say we are not prepared. As an Indian citizen, I say we should not even attempt to. Okay, so now these are all extremely damaging, extremely depressing, and extremely poisonous narratives that he's sort of using his 30, 40-year-old career as a media commentator and the kind of mind space that he has sort of achieved. Right? So, and he has his own self-styled website, ramachandraguha.com. His output is relentless. Okay, no, probably 20 of our right-wing so-called experts, journalists, and warriors cannot match the output of one guy like Ramachandra Guha. Okay? So now, if we were to deconstruct him as a febrile historian, so we need to figure out what are the features of his intellectual output, what are his possible goals, what does he aim to achieve with his brand of critique, who are his primary audience, and whom does he hope to influence? Okay, so now the key thing is, I use a couple of tropes from Rajiv Ji's work. One is this whole notion of Western universalism, right? So he'd be the most happy, Guha would be the most happiest if he turned into a Western state. Okay, so it's relentless about the need to create foundations of Western universalism. Second thing is, there's simply no engagement with Dharma vocabulary. At least historians like Trushke or Romila Thapar are forced to read the sources in original because they're doing history. Now, Guha is a contemporary historian. He just reads today's current affairs using historical methods, and there's no sort of enforcement on him to even engage with any of Dharma's vocabulary or any of Sanatana's lenses at all. Okay, so everything he sees through the most modern form of Western lens. All right? So the current affairs rhetoric is also given the treatment of history. So now we need to do some, given this supposedly a Swadeshi Indology conference. So what do you deconstruct as a using a Swadeshi sort of methodology? Now, is all the output that he's generating, all his writing, is it actually causing any dharma? Question one. Now, if it is not, is he identifying from where adharma is coming? Okay, assuming he is writing to protect the nation. So is he actually identifying any adharma here? On whose side is he on? Okay. So there's no notion of neutral. That is, dharma is a side by itself. Right? So there's no notion of neutral commentator. Or all of that is just not happening if you actually use a Swadeshi lens. Okay, and is his writing provoking any dharmic action in the reader? Okay, so these are fundamental sort of, shall we say, hermeneutic aids that Mimamsa actually asks if you want to find out the prayojan of a Shastra. Is the Shastra actually considered to be a Shastra at all? If any of these four are not there, so it is just kalpitam, or rather imagination of the writer. Okay, so if you look at all of these four, none of these would even be applicable to any of Guha's sort of four decade output. Okay, so that is why I think the febrile historian is still, I think, a pretty lightweight sort of description, and also, okay, Ravana is probably the most apt for him as of now. So the general observations. So one of the strongest proponents of colonial Indology and this extensive use of Western categories and experience to investigate India, especially Hinduism. So this sort of, he sort of has become part of the ecosystem developed over the last 250 years, a relentless assault on Sanatana civilization through systematic study using flawed methods of interpretation. This has resulted in many conflicts within India, and it is feeding the Breaking India forces. Now, his process of doing this, okay, he's in the forefront of delineating Hindutva and Hinduism. We saw examples of Shashi Tharoor, but he's been doing this for the last 15 years, 20 years. He abhors and deeply despises the notion of a civilizational India. He effectively shepherds and curates the narratives of the fibrils. He selectively usurps the Brahminical label, applies it to himself. So he calls them Brahminical at many positions, and critiques them from the mainstream using well-rehearsed good cop, bad cop routines. Now he, among the Indian Western liberals, he is the one who uses the most latest theories, latest vocabularies, later interpretations from the Western Enlightenment, let's say, in infrastructure, both in Europe and in North America. Okay, no other Indian liberal author is even as close to his range of using theories to interpret contemporary India. Now, the historian part, okay, again, spoken by Bakshiji and Rajivji, and also in the morning referred to by Madhukeshwarji. So this whole quote, inside every thinking Indian, there's a Gandhian and a Marxist struggling for supremacy, right? So this is sort of a major narrative in all his, he sort of speaks for all of you. So now you guys have to tell me if this is right or not. He's talking about you. So yeah, right or not? Is he right? Now, as is evident from earlier sections discussing narrative on personalities of Nehru and Gandhi, his interpretations are loaded with subtle manipulations and littered with the manufacturing of intent. Now, he uses Gandhi, Nehru, Marx, all of them, their works, their quotes to push his agenda. So he'll never tell him, I'm saying this. He will say, Gandhi said this in this, which is also an interpretation. Right? His most sort of weapon is in his arsenal is a selective use of quotes and facts. And very importantly, as expected, he uses no traditional native source of history, right? No local itihasa, no sthala purana, none of the regional understandings of self, none of those are even used. And if at all he uses them, he'll use them as caricatures and props to distract the reader. Now, delineations of Western ideology are adhered to. He makes emotional appeals based on vigorous pleas to some ideals based on, again, Videshi Siddhanta. So most important is this nation unbuilding poison. So I start off the essay with a quote from Rajivji's 2002 Sulekha essay, which Sankranji also referred to in the morning. He talks about the role of a historian doing two things. One can be nation builder and one can be nation unbuilder. So fundamentally, Guha's role has been as a nation unbuilder. Right, so now this is sort of his sort of peak evolution. So there's a book of collection of essays called The Functioning Anarchy. This essays for Guha, and probably around more than half the authors are Western scholars in the Western academic ecosystem. And the impact this kind of book has on the, not necessarily the left-wing authors, but also on the right-wing wannabes, is that here is a person who is being celebrated as an ecosystem builder by the Western intellectual themselves. Okay, this is a very, very powerful statement on the power of Guha. And this most important takeaway, so this whole notion of collective meaning making, how do we make sense of who we are, what we are, right, as people of Dharma. So his fundamental role is to poison this collective meaning making of the collective. So that is why he's a very, very, very dangerous Ravana. Right, so I just summarize the takeaways, his use of dharma categories and dismissive use of categories, established ignorance of Sanskrit knowledge systems is glaring. So a lot of these, again, in one of the notes in the essay, I've given a 20-point takeaway. You could probably read just that for this, for a summary of his, why his poison is so dangerous. Right, so now key takeaway again is how his sort of his text, importantly, a lot of his text is highly prioritized in the training of AI bots, which are trained on commenting on Indian content, right? So he's already, his weight of validity among the test data given to the example I gave of ChatGPT is actually very, very high, right? So now Guha is a recognized master in breaking India by breaking Dharma. He uses a multi-step methodical approach to excavate fault lines, curates them, and makes them contemporary, right? So now in Guha, so given all of this, now we don't have Guha here. I think we invited him, he didn't turn up. So how do we use, so who is going to defend Guha? So again, I go back to ChatGPT again, okay? So ask him, is Guha really a dharmic person? So very interestingly, see the last paragraph, right? So it says it's appropriate to focus on Guha's contributions to Indian historiography and intellectual legacy, rather than trying to label him based on an understanding of dharma. Okay, we already know how deeply manipulated existing AI systems already are with the kind of content that people like Guha already produce. Okay, so now this is a generic question on, could Guha be called a Ravana? What does today's most intelligent person respond to? He says, to compare a real life individual to a mythological character, again loaded, especially one that is often depicted negatively, is unfair and inaccurate. So Ramchandra Guha is a respected historian, biographer and writer who has made significant contributions to the Indian intellectual life. It is not appropriate to compare him to a mythological character in this manner. Right? So this is his defense by, ChatGPT is defending Guha, right? So yeah, that's it. Thank you.